Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
And now on BBC World Service, the second part of Europe's Choice. Alan Little looks at some of the key moments and issues that lie behind the current crisis in the European Union. This week's programme begins in the messy wake of Britain's general election in 2010.
The news headlines this morning: Britain is heading for a hung parliament. That appears to be...
I want to make a big, open and comprehensive offer to the Liberal Democrats.
I think it would be best if everybody were just to take a little time so that people get the good...
Saturday, the 8th of May, 2010. Alistair Darling was surprised to find that he was still the minister in charge of UK finances. The political party he belonged to had lost the general election, but no party had a majority, so no new government was yet in office. He found himself unexpectedly back at 11 Downing Street, his former official London residence.
I left fully confident that I would not darken the doors of the place again, because, you know, I was pretty clear that we weren't going to win the election, frankly. And, of course, having vacated the flat, there's practicalities, like there's no sheets, no blankets, no toothbrush, nothing.
Next day, Sunday the 9th, he had to head to Brussels. Europe was in turmoil.
European Union finance ministers have been discussing measures to prevent the Greek debt crisis from spreading to other countries.
The idea that this meeting would wrap up in the late afternoon was always optimistic.
He didn't want to commit the incoming government to anything, so he'd already informed the European Commission that Britain would not contribute to the bailout fund that was now desperately needed. What happened next would demonstrate a key weakness of the EU as an institution: its inability to take decisive action in a moment of urgency.
This is yet another one of these meetings where, instead of sitting down at the appointed time and saying, right, what is the issue here? The issue is we've got to put together a rescue fund, because if we don't do that, the European Central Bank will not agree to buying bonds of distressed countries. And there were one or two other smaller points, but that was the big thing. So what happens? The meeting doesn't start for, I think it was like a couple of hours late. The European Commission put forward proposals that we had to contribute to it, despite me having told the Commissioner there was no way we were going to do that. This went on for hour after hour after hour.
The urgency was clear. They all understood. It was a Sunday evening and the Asian markets would open within hours. The politicians present knew and would later admit that there was a real danger that the euro would fall apart that very night.
I'd had a number of conversations with Tim Geithner, the US Treasury Secretary, who was increasingly concerned, if not frightened, at Europe's inability and unwillingness to deal with what he saw as a growing catastrophe in Greece. And I remember being party to one of these big phone calls with half a dozen finance ministers, when again and again he kept saying, what are you guys going to do about it?
For this programme on the BBC World Service, I'm going to look at the paradox this crisis highlighted. It's one that goes to the heart of political Europe, and one that will now have to change. The EU is often characterised as undemocratic and unaccountable, as having usurped the sovereign rights of the nations. But if you thought that the EU was undemocratic and over-centralised before this crisis, get ready to be further outraged by what lies ahead. On that night in 2010, as so often in the past, the EU found itself paralysed, not by the centralisation of power in Brussels, but by the dispersal of real power among 27 sovereign nation-states that couldn't agree.
There have been attempts, for example, to have some sort of leadership in Europe. We made an attempt to have a troika, to have Britain join France and Germany in making some of the decisions in Europe. Our attempt to do that was a bit of a failure.
Jonathan Powell was chief of staff to former British Prime Minister Tony Blair.
We had one meeting after 9/11 with Chirac and Schroeder that went fine, and then we tried to have a follow-up meeting in Downing Street. But as soon as it became public, we had telephone calls from everyone else demanding to come. So first Mr Berlusconi called and said he had to come. He absolutely insisted on it, so we allowed him to come. Then we had Mr Aznar of Spain who called and said, if you're having the Italians, you've certainly got to have me in. I have to come. Then we had the president of the commission call and said that he had to come, and he had to bring with him the Belgian Prime Minister, Guy Verhofstadt, because he was president of the EU. And then finally, just as we were sitting down to dinner, Wim Kok called me on my mobile and said he was coming as well, because the Netherlands needed to be represented. And I had to tell him we'd run out of food and he had to have the vegetarian option.
Everyone wants to be at the top table. It's a matter of prestige. A public finance crisis in Greece shouldn't matter very much. Greece accounts for only 2% of Europe's economy. But in a Europe of the single, borderless currency, contagion spreads. So it matters very much. In the mid-1990s, the economist Miranda Zaffa had left her native Greece to join Salomon Brothers in London. She was watching and writing reports for the investment firm as Greece made its preparations to join the euro. Member states had to prove that they had low national debt, 60% of GDP at most, low annual budget deficits, 3% of GDP at most, and low inflation. Greece cooked the books.
For example, there was a rule set by Eurostat, the statistical agency of the Commission, saying that transfers to public enterprises are not counted as expenditure if they are matched by equal equity participations. So let's say the Greek railroads that lose about $1 billion a year has more employees than passengers. The former minister Stefanos Manos had said publicly at the time that it's cheaper to send people by taxi. How did they cover this deficit? Well, it was as if the company would issue more shares that the government would buy, and then that was not counted as expenditure. It was a financial transaction.
Let's pause for a moment to take that in. The Greek railways were losing $1 billion a year. The state was paying. But the government declared that it was using this money to buy equity in the railway company. So that huge €1 billion loss did not appear as an item of expenditure in the nation's budget. It was hidden, deliberately, pushed into the distant future as debt.
What you've got in front of you here is a paper you wrote that you prepared.
Yes, yes. So this report is dated December 15, 1998. And it explained these various tricks. So all that was out in the markets. It was not a surprise that a decade later are where we are.
So you knew, because you wrote it in this paper, that Greece wasn't.
And all the clients of Salomon Brothers knew. So I used to come to Athens from London with clients of Salomon Brothers. And we always saw the head of the statistical agency of Greece that compiled all these statistics on the debt, the deficits, inflation, etc. We used to call him the magician because he made inflation disappear and then he also made the deficits disappear.
By 2004, Greece was already a member of the Eurozone, but the artifice was now beginning to show. The conjuring tricks were becoming transparent. That year, Peter Doukas took over as budget minister. He wanted to look in detail at the nation's balance sheet.
I invited the senior staff of the ministry and asked them to give me all the details of the budget that had been voted in the previous December, 2.5 months before I took over. And I said, don't worry about persecution or anything, just tell me what the true story is and we can work out, that's fine.
What was the difference between the budget that had been prepared and the real balance sheet?
It was virtually about a 7% of GDP difference because the budget said there's going to be a 1.5% deficit. And the actual deficit based on that budget was 8.3% difference.
How did that happen?
That's a very good question. And I guess governments tend to want to show a more optimistic light. They don't want to discourage people by painting blue picture that people may actually walk away from things or investors would walk away. And you want to preserve a climate of optimism.
And so what were your feelings when you found out the truth?
Well, I said that it's an alarming situation and we should start chopping down the budget. But the answer at the time was, listen, we're having Olympic Games in a few months and we cannot upset the whole population and start having strikes and everything just before the Olympic Games.
So instead of reforming the public finances, Greece borrowed and borrowed and committed to debts that generations not yet born would have to pay off.
I said, let's borrow for 20, 30 and 50 years. And those times were easy years. And pretty much bankers would line up and beg us virtually to borrow from them rather than from another bank.
What's more, Greece could borrow cheaply at very low interest rates. Investors assumed their money was safe because Greece was in the euro. It got credit on the same conditions, give or take, as Germany. The so-called spreads, the differences in the rates at which sound and unsound economies could borrow, seemed to have disappeared. Suddenly, in this one very narrow respect, every country was Germany. Dietrich von Keogh was German ambassador to the EU in the 1990s.
We didn't understand or didn't foresee that due to this wonderfully successful appearing monetary union, everybody would get similar conditions as Germany would. Now we have these enormous spreads again, as they were before monetary union. But for too long, they didn't really come to play.
The markets just did not believe there was a risk of default. They failed to see the debt mountains that were accumulating. Eurozone members were obliged by treaty to keep their budget deficits below 3% of GDP. Member states had signed up to something called the Stability and Growth Pact that allowed the EU to punish governments that breached this limit by fining them. How serious was the EU about enforcing this commitment?
You had a treaty obligation to get your debt down to 60% of GDP, didn't you?
Right.
What was your view of that treaty obligation, given that you were riding at well over 100% of GDP?
Well, as I said, I was in the minority that said, let's squeeze things and push things. People didn't feel there was going to be any consequence, you know, if you can borrow, and this was a prevailing attitude. Again, I was a very, very small minority, not in Greece, in Europe, because Europe didn't see that problem coming.
Was there any pressure coming from Europe? From the Commission, from those charged with regulating the Treaty of Maastricht, seeing that it was enforced?
Yeah, there was pressure, but not the sort of thing that is breathing down your neck. Yeah. Everybody who could read the numbers could see that the numbers are off, even if you allow for constructive accounting or whatever.
Four months before Peter Dukas took office in 2004, the Stability and Growth Pact was as good as dead. Both France and Germany had shattered the rule that limited budget deficits to 3% of GDP. Germany, the great European financial disciplinarian, the nation for whom inflation was a living trauma, the nation that above all others could be trusted to live within its means, was struggling. The cost of reunification after the fall of the wall in 1989 had left a big hole in its budget. Now Germany and France had broken the very rules they'd insisted on for everyone else. The former German ambassador to the EU, Dietrich von Keogh.
They really sinned by doing something not very serious, which was one of the consequences of German unification and the enormous expenditures there. They've flexibilized the schedules primarily. It was not a real sin. But when a big country does that, how can you afterwards impose on smaller countries, including Greece, to obey by the rules?
The view was that, if the big boys won't adhere and impose discipline on themselves, they're going to be more relaxed in terms of the treaty.
The former Greek budget minister, Peter Dukas, speaking to the BBC World Service.
I mean, nobody can impose sanctions on Germany, which is a superpower by European standards, and similarly to France. So they don't adhere. The pressure was simply not there.
France and Germany should have been fined by the EU. The safekeeping of the single currency required it. It was the European Commission's job to do that as a way of enforcing the Stability and Growth Pact. But as always, the unelected European Commission ran up against something much more powerful in the EU, the democratically elected national governments, on this occasion in the shape of ECOFIN, the Council of Finance Ministers.
The crucial event for the development of the Stability and Growth Pact happened very shortly after I'd arrived, in November 2003, during the Italian presidency, at an ECOFIN meeting in Brussels, in a small room with a round table, as I recall, because in those days that was before enlargement, and there were still only 15 of us in the room.
Sir John Grant, who was at the time Britain's ambassador to the EU.
In other words, to make public the failure of France and Germany to correct its excessive deficit was not accepted by the Council. There wasn't a qualified majority. There weren't enough countries in the Council who voted in favour of what the Commission wanted to do.
So, basically, a majority of the finance ministers sitting around that table voted to let France and Germany off.
That's what the Council decided, yeah.
How did Britain vote on that day?
Britain voted with the French and German position.
Gordon Brown.
Can't remember whether the Chancellor was in the room at the time, but that was the United Kingdom's position.
France and Germany on that occasion had disregarded their obligations under the Maastricht Treaty, breached their obligations under the Maastricht Treaty, and Britain voted to let them do it without sanction.
Well, they're your words, not mine, but the record shows that we didn't vote in favour of the Commission proposal.
Does that mean that the Stability and Growth Pact, which was intended as a mechanism to make sure that countries who were sharing a currency didn't damage each other's currencies and economies by overspending, failed as a mechanism, as a system?
It didn't fail as a mechanism at that point, in the sense that, you know, I think you'd find many economists who would argue that the problem wasn't the 3% deficit or the trajectory of reduction only. There were a whole bunch of other things that lie behind the difficulties that the euro faces at the moment. But the credibility of the Commission and the readiness of the member states to accept the authority of the Commission as the politically independent enforcer of the Maastricht criteria was obviously gravely undermined.
In the optimistic mood of 2003, with economies growing and Europe on the verge of a dramatic eastern expansion, this didn't much matter. But later, when crisis hit, the old divide would open up again. The elected bodies like the Council of Ministers versus the unelected like the Commission. To rescue the Stability Pact, the Commission would have needed to be far stronger. But that would have led to cries of outrage about the democratic legitimacy of faceless EU bureaucrats issuing diktats. Sir Stephen Wall is a former chief advisor on Europe to the British government.
One of the paradoxes, really, in a way, or contradictions within the single currency, is that institutionally, in European terms, it's rather weak. I mean, the European Commission, which ought to be the authority with the power of enforcement, is deliberately given very little power. For what was, in a way, the sort of climax of the what was supposed to be the sort of the traditional community method, it was very intergovernmental, with all the weaknesses that that implies, that basically, if you can't get agreement among everybody, you're stuck.
Again, the paralysis that so frustrated Alistair Darling in his last weekend as Chancellor. The institutional answer is clear. Give the Commission the power to cut through the inertia caused by national disagreements and allow it to force member states to obey the rules they've agreed to. The problem with that is profound and so far unanswered. It's not very democratic. Should there be a more powerful but democratically elected Commission? John, now Lord Kerr, is a former British ambassador to the EU.
I think it should not be democratised. It's very important that the Commission should be the unpopular policeman of the rules, the person who takes you to court, the person who insists that what is written down in legislation, the single market, is actually applied by the member states. Nobody likes the policeman, but the last thing you want is a Commission where people regard themselves as their country's representatives inside the Commission. It should be run by a very powerful figure, and its job should be to look after the common interest, not the interest of any particular country.
I am one of the small fathers of the Stability Pact, so I'm not going to throw the baby out through the window, but we had our doubts that an ex post punitive system would be completely workable and sufficient to hold the monetary union together in the long run.
Jacques Lafitte was at the time a French Treasury official seconded to Brussels to help build the single currency. He says the pact emerged as a compromise. The punishment it allowed for governments that crashed through the deficit limits was, as he says, ex post punitive. In other words, the Commission could only fine them after they'd broken the rules. This was flawed in several ways. First, the sanction came too late to prevent the overspend, and the subsequent fine would make the overspend even worse. That's another reason why, when the crunch came, those finance ministers at the ECOFIN meeting voted to let Germany and France off. Lafitte and others wanted the Commission to have the preemptive power to prevent member countries overspending in the first place, what he calls an ex-ante punishment system.
We did make a number of other suggestions to the member states at the time that were rejected because they would have resulted in transferring sovereignty from national capitals to Brussels or maybe Frankfurt.
What kind of systems did you propose?
All sorts of things. One of the issues that was about the external representation of the euro. Who would be Mr. Euro in front of, say, the US authorities? On the banking side was clear, would be the president of the ECB. On the political side was far less clear. Member states essentially said, we don't need anything like this. Commission, go away.
Because it involved a transfer of sovereignty from member states to the centre?
Yes, that has always been the issue.
The Stability Pact at the time was the best enforcement mechanism you could get?
Yes. Deep inside, I was convinced it would not be enough. Although I wrote certain bits and pieces of the Stability Pact myself, I was dead sure that we need an ex-ante convergence system.
So member states retained the power to police themselves, and as we now know, this in some cases included the power to cook their books and disguise their real expenditure and publish hopelessly unrealistic accounts of their economic performance year after year. There was no EU institution with the power to enforce it. Until now, that is. For the Eurozone is now moving in this direction. Soon, national governments will have to submit their annual budgets in advance for approval in Brussels, before they put them to their national parliaments. And the shape of what is to come can be seen clearly on the Berlaymont building, which houses the European Commission in the heart of Brussels. Draped down the side of it across many stories is an enormous blue banner whose slogan captures the direction in which Europe is now moving. The slogan says, towards a stronger European economic governance. This crisis has made even more fraught a very old tension in Europe. How long will it be before national populations start to say, wait a minute, is the government that we elected accountable downwards to we the people? Or is it accountable upwards to a bunch of people whose names we don't even know who work in the European Commission? Next week in Europe's Choice on the BBC World Service, can the centre hold if national populations revolt in the name of democracy?
Of course the European Union won't last forever. It emerged from a particular historical constellation after 1945. Ironically, the next great moment in European history, 1989, was a moment of unification but also sowed the seeds of disunification. I would say, be careful what you wish for.
Europe's Choice was presented by Alan Little and produced by Jane Beresford.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.